I'm Christopher Lydon. This is The Connection.
This is ABC.
I'm Jim McKay speaking to you live at this moment from ABC headquarters, Munich, West Germany. The Olympics of Serenity have become the one thing the Germans didn't want them to be, the Olympics of Terror.
The Munich Olympics and the Palestinian massacre of Israeli athletes on September 5, 1972, made one of those searing moments of the television age, like the assassination of President Kennedy, that has never really faded. The world got to watch it live for 21 hours because the long lenses of ABC Sports and some marvelous reporters like Jim McKay and Peter Jennings had all been gathered to cover the Summer Games. And we remember it not just for the arbitrary murder of innocents, but for the stark imagery of hooded gunmen on a balcony of the Olympic Village, the image of Israel's Golda Meir saying a flat no to negotiations, the image of German officialdom huddling nonetheless with the hostage takers. The new movie called One Day in September, which won the documentary Oscar last spring and only now is reaching the public, makes you wonder if we understand Munich even now. The movie makes it a saga of multiple blunders by the Palestinians, first and last, who introduced the world not to their cause, but to their callous cruelty in this case. But there were blunders also by the Germans, who spectacularly failed their security assignment. Connection listeners, 28 years and many Summer Games later, can you sort what you remember, what you know, what you never knew or never wanted to know about the Olympics of Terror in 1972? Our phone is 1-800-423-8255. The movie producer Arthur Cohn is our guest in the studio. The movie director, Kevin McDonald, joins us by phone from Bulgaria. We're talking about One Day in September, a brazen raid calculated at the time to change hearts and minds, and it did. So perhaps will the movie. But how? Join the conversation at 1-800-423-TALK. Arthur Cohn, what hearts and minds did you set out to change or to inform in this case with the movie?
Well, my director, Kevin McDonald, and I did not set out to change anything. We wanted to tell the story and the history of what happened, what really happened in Munich 72. And this story has not been told for 28 years, which is amazing enough. And we went out to tell the story with an enormous research for unique archive material on the one hand, and the other hand, the brave and courageous endeavor to find the protagonists of 72 who wear the helm at the time and who are acting in our film. We have no actors. We only have the heads in Germany, the heads in Israel, the only surviving terrorists who tell the story. And I think their participation make the film so authentic.
There's some important news in this movie. At several levels, and I'm not sure all of the news is nailed down finally, but there's a story here of, finally, at the very end, of the German government, it seems, conspiring with the Palestinians to let them go to Libya. There's a deeper story or another story about sort of endless German screw-ups in the security planning, in the security execution. But maybe the biggest news, I suppose, in the story, and the most affecting, the most troubling, is the long interview with the last surviving terrorist, Jamal al-Gashi. I wonder if you'd summarize what you think Jamal al-Gashi said, how you found him, if you can talk about that, and what he tells us about this event.
Well, I think we should address this question to my director, Kevin McDonald, because it was due to him and to him alone that we found Jamal through his Palestinian connections. And it was Kevin who spoke to Jamal. What is very interesting about this is not only that Kevin traced him down, but that Jamal was extremely cordial and eager to talk. Unlike many participants and protagonists in Germany who were not anxious to talk, he was anxious to tell the story of what really happened in Munich. But as for details of Jamal, I think we better ask Kevin, because he was there. It was him who traced him down. It was him who interviewed him. And
Kevin McDonald, please leap right in. I mean, this is a remarkable scoop, in a way, 28 years later, to have interviewed a main participant, the only survivor in hiding in Africa. Tell us how you found him, and then tell us what he said.
Well, as you can understand, I can't say too much about how we found him, just really that I was lucky enough to have a very, very, very good Palestinian researcher and intermediary who knew Jamal of old and who was able to persuade him on our behalf. As Arthur has said, in fact, he was relatively easy to persuade compared to other people, Israelis and Germans in particular. And what he tells is his personal story about what he remembers as an individual, as a human being, as an 18-year-old boy, what he did on the fifth of September 1972, and we were very keen to make this a human story, as I said before, and to not get it bogged down too much in politics. Obviously, this subject, there is so much backstory that we could have gone into, so much analysis we could have gone into. We did do another interview with a senior political figure in the Black September movement, a man called Abu Daoud, but decided in the end not to use that because he refused to talk in a personal manner and because it was all extremely ideological, extremely, extremely political. What we wanted from Jamal was really his personal recollections of that day and his personal feelings now about.
Well, it's a very difficult assignment. It's a very difficult assignment you set yourself. I mean, to make it human, not to make it excessively political, obviously not to make a terrorist and a killer sympathetic, and yet also to get a straight story of the event. Summarize what you learned from Jamal al-Ghashi about deeply the human story as well as what happened.
I think it's fair to say that we, in terms of the new information that is in the film, or information which is new to most of the public that's in the film, I don't think he provided very much of that. I think there were bits and pieces which he did provide, such as that when the eight Palestinians broke into the Olympic compound very early on in the morning, about 4:30 in the morning on the 5th of September, they were dressed as athletes, and they were actually helped over by other athletes, and he claims American athletes, who were coming back drunk after a night out on the town, who didn't want to come in through the main gate. Perhaps there was a curfew on them, and apparently very frequently this used to happen. Athletes would go out on the town, they'd come back a bit drunk, they'd climb over the fences, and these athletes, apparently American athletes, helped the eight Palestinians just climb over the fence. It's those sorts of details that he provides. It's not, as I said before, the large political dimensions or any scoops in terms of news, I think.
And yet, to me, you know, if I can just speak as one viewer of the movie, he is the emotional center of it, and he's completely fascinating. We don't learn an awful lot of his personal experience and the human history that sent him into training, but we do get a very clear portrait of a man who, put it this way, he's the one person in the movie, really, who says 28 years later, yeah, I knew what I was doing, I did what I meant to do, not exactly I'm glad I did it, but that there was a purpose and we executed the plan. Everybody else is embarrassed or angry or in denial or heartbroken.
Well, absolutely. I think
he's the one man who, in a certain way, hasn't changed, who doesn't even now see irony and tragedy.
Well, I think that's natural. I mean, if you imagine that somebody is an 18-year-old who's basically a kid, who's very impressionable, he's done this because he thinks it's the right thing to do, both politically and also personally. It's a way out of the camps, which you see at the start of the film that he is inhabiting as a child. He's a second-generation refugee. He sees his life as being hopeless. So he has, in a way, managed to get himself out of the camps. He has managed to make a life for himself. He has managed to, in his eyes, promote the Palestinian cause. The irony, of course, is that this was also a terribly damaging thing for the Palestinian cause. It was one of the one of the events which made the world think of Palestinian and terrorist as being synonymous words for many years.
Well, that's exactly the sort of the core grotesque irony at the heart of the story. He said in Libya, or one of them said, after the terrorists were released to Libya, he said, "We have made our voice heard by the world, which has not been hearing before."
Yes.
They heard and saw, and they saw sort of unspeakable cruelty.
I mean, in my impression is that he today feels that what he did at the time was the correct thing to do, and that it did some good for his cause, but that from today's perspective, obviously, it's not something that he would like to see happen again in today's environment. It's something that belonged very much to the environment and to the time at which he did it. But of course, you've also got to remember, on a human level, I imagine somebody like this, you know, his whole life has been marked by this one day when he was an 18-year-old. He's still living in hiding, still scared, all because of what he did on this one day. He can't very well turn around and reject it. I think that would be rejecting the basis for his entire life. Obviously, that's pure psychological supposition, but I think it's fairly safe to say.
Arthur Cohen.
I think it is very remarkable that Jamal says at the end, very clearly, "I do not regret what happened in Munich after 28 years. And these words are clearly marked, and they are, in my opinion, a very honest admission of his political aims, but at the same time, it's frightening that after 28 years, the man who helped to murder 11 innocent artists did not see his way to change his view. But I did find, I must say, very remarkable that he was so honest about it. Yet the film is showing very clearly, because of the great personality of Jamal, which you have rightly described as such, that the political aims of the film were to put Palestine on the map as of what happened in Munich, to put Palestine on the map on behalf of the terrorists. But at the same time, we do show in the film that it is absolutely unacceptable that Olympic games of sport and of friendship should be intruded by terror, and we show the brutal terror which was committed at the same time in Munich.
Well, we knew that in a way, right? We knew that the Olympic Games cannot be invaded by terror.
But we knew it, but we learned in Munich that it is possible, and our hope is 3 or 4 days before the Olympic Games in Sydney that it will not happen again.
The question that I'm especially interested in hearing from Connection listeners about is how the Munich Olympics and the images, which were so stark and so powerful and at the same time so opaque and so unclear, so inarticulate, have affected their own heads, all of our heads, for almost 30 years, in thinking about Palestinians and thinking about the Middle East and thinking about sports and thinking about Germans, too, and counterterrorism, for that matter. Who wants to tell the stories of how the Germans screwed up here? The Germans who, after the awful embarrassments of 1936, the Hitler Olympics, were suddenly back in the sun in Munich in 1972.
I'm not sure if awful embarrassments is really the correct phrase to use for the 1936 Games. Do you think so?
The Germans in 72 and today feel embarrassed by this.
Embarrassed in 1936, I don't think.
Not in 36.
It was a piece of propaganda.
No. I'm saying part of the context in 72 was the German recovery from the embarrassment of 36.
These games were very much founded with the specific aim of bringing Germany back into the democratic world.
That's what I mean.
Change. They were a piece of public relations. They were a public relations exercise, which went terribly wrong. And that's why this was such a tragedy for Germany also, because for Germany this meant much, much more than it would to any other country holding the Olympic Games. It's meant much more that this games go off smoothly, that they go off without any violence. That's what gives an added poignancy, I think,
and yet
to the story, an added complexity.
As the movie says, though, the whole myth of kind of German efficiency, high purpose, brutal clarity falls apart in before your eyes.
The irony is that that myth is part of Germany's problem and is part of what they're trying to get over. And that's really the point of what the film is saying at that moment.
Just how did they screw it up as badly as they did?
Sorry, just let me finish. Is that the man who says that there is, a myth of German efficiency that has been exploded that day is really saying what the Germans would like to everyone to realize, which is, you know, this idea of militarism and efficiency, cold, harsh efficiency, is something that went with the Third Reich.
I think we have to divide what the Germans did in the Olympic Village and what they did at the airport. In the Olympic Village, they had various ideas to free the Israeli athletes, and there were two things against them. One, the East German collaboration with the terrorists, which is revealed in this film, where we know now for sure that the East Germans tipped off the terrorists time and again of German plans to free the Israelis. The second, the endeavor of the
Olympics. Explain that. That's still not clear to me. You say the East Germans tipped off the terrorists about the German security ring closing.
No, the West German police had various plans in the offing to free the Israelis in the Olympic Village. The East Germans were stationed one floor above, and they are known now to have tipped off the West Germans of various efforts to free the Israelis. That is one thing, the collaboration of East Germany and the terrorists, which was not known to such an extent. The other thing, which is perhaps even more significant, is that the Olympic movement and the Olympic Committee was very anxious that the Games must continue. And they realized that the Games cannot continue if the Israelis remain in the Olympic Village. Consequently, there was an enormous pressure on the West German government and on the government of Bavaria to ship out or help to ship out the Israelis from the Olympic Village so that the Games could continue and go on. This is as far as the Olympic Village is concerned. When then the terrorists went out by helicopter with the Israeli captives to join a plane at Fürstenfeldbruck Airport to be flown to an Arab land, there was a very, very brilliant German plan. And the plan saw to it that there were 12 policemen stationed in the plane, dressed as pursers, pilots, airline employees, and they would overwhelm the head of the terrorist, ISA, who would go to inspect the plane. And everybody was pretty sure that if either would be captured or killed, the other terrorist would give up. That plan, in a very tragic and incredible manner, went bust when the policemen made founding between themselves and discussed it, and they felt that it was too difficult a job, and they considered it a suicide mission, which is unbelievable, as that policemen can be as coward as they are. I came here from a screening at the Washington at the French embassy, and various people asked why the policemen in Germany, who loused up the whole affair by not admitting and doing what they were supposed to do, fouled up, why they were not court-martialed and brought to trial. And this has not happened. And this, in my opinion, is the biggest blunder, what happened at the airport, that the Germans didn't do the plan they wanted to do and thereby gave way to the killing which then happened.
It is a very strange moment when German police say, no, we won't take the assignment because we might get killed. But there's an even more ignominious point at the end of the movie, after the blowout at the airport in which the last of the Israelis were killed and many of the terrorists, there were two or three terrorists left in German hands.
Three.
And the government of Willy Brandt basically wanted them off their hands. The movie says that the German government was in on the sort of pseudo hijacking of a Lufthansa jet.
Well, the movie
handed back the terrorists.
If I could chip in there, the movie doesn't quite say exactly that. What the movie says is that what the narration says is that we have heard from a Palestinian source, who would not appear on camera, obviously, we have heard from a Palestinian source that this is what happened, that the Germans colluded with a Palestinian group in order to set up a hijacking, so that the in exchange for the prisoners on the hijacked plane, the three surviving Palestinians would be released. That we then go on to show the response of two senior German officials, a man called General Ulrich Wegener, who is the head of the GSG9, the anti-specialist anti-terrorist group that was set up after Munich, and probably the man who knows more about terrorism in Germany than anybody else, and then the ex-mayor of Munich. We confront them with this, and they both respond in a way which leads one to suspect that this is true, that the German government did cooperate, but we do not state categorically this is what happened. We present the audience with our findings, with what we've been told by a nameless Palestinian source, and what is then the response of two German officials. And I think it's really up to the audience to make up their own minds about this. It's something which we could not, obviously, prove 100%. We could not find a piece of paper that says this, but I don't think that we pretend otherwise.
But
Arthur Cohen, what did the German embassy say about that point?
It was very fascinating that the film was shown in Germany on state-owned television. The papers were full of the film. We have nothing but praise. I told to my very dear director, Kevin, that we have not met any country in the world where we got such enormous praise. And both Kevin and I were frightened to show it in Germany because we thought that we would get a very adverse reviews and criticism. But there was not one paper which raised the subject of the hijacking, which gives me reason to think that the hijacking did occur in collaboration with the Germans. And in a way, it makes sense that the German did not want at all to have given access indirectly to new terror acts in order to free the three. But it is a fact that, number one, the Palestinian source, which Kevin quoted, is a top, top, top source. Number two, there were no children on board of the plane. Number three, there were no women on board of the plane. And number four, in this enormous plane, there were only 12 passengers. And number five, the Germans freed the three terrorists within enormous haste of a little bit more than half an hour, and without consulting Israel or the United States.
Hmm. And I think the point to be made also is that probably the real reason for this is not simply that they wanted to get the three survivors off their hands. I think that's probably a little too cynical, but really they were obviously threatened. The Palestinian group, the group who carried this out, were not Black September, it was the PFLP group, who were renowned for their hijackings and for violent attacks, also in a similar way to Black September. They, from what my source told me, threatened the German government and said, look, if you don't release these three guys, then we're going to carry out more terror attacks in Germany, we're going to hijack more planes, so why don't we come to an arrangement? And that arrangement, of course, I think happened to suit the German authorities also.
But also,
as the German general says, who was subsequently the head of the anti-terrorist group in Germany, this is just the attitude that the Germans had at that time towards terrorism, which is that you can do deals with terrorists. They subsequently learned, like most other countries, that you can't do deals with terrorists.
I'm interested, Arthur Cohen, that the Germans' audience and critics like the movie. I want to come back to the question of the people who don't in Israel and among the Palestinian folk, not to mention the producers of the Buena Vista Social Club, who thought they should have won the Oscar. That's another whole question, but we'll come back to the matter of criticism of this movie. First, the phone calls, 1-800-423-8255, makes the One Day in September connection with the producer, Arthur Cohen, and the director of the movie, Kevin MacDonald. Martin is on the line. Welcome,
I'm calling in from Somerville. I was a 9-year-old boy when I watched the Olympics. I was eager to see my first Olympics, being a son of a sports editor. And I remember how shocked I was when it happened, and that I indeed, for a long time, saw terrorism and the PLO to be the same thing, being strongly influenced by that. But that's not necessarily what I wanted to talk about. I wanted to go back to the German efficiency, so to say. And I also remember that, yes, indeed, the Germans were extremely efficient in providing infrastructure and organizing the Olympics, but not at all prepared to deal with terrorism and events like that. And the GSG-9 has just been mentioned before. It's only after the Olympics that they came up with an anti-terrorist unit, people psychologically prepared to take action. In stark contrast, of course, to the policemen who were in charge, who were not trained to do this, and who were not psychologically prepared to do anything of that kind of caliber. That's what I remember. And I also remember, and that has not been mentioned, how tragic it was and how embarrassed everybody was back then in Germany, and how they really truly felt sorry that not just that that happened in Germany, but...
Martin, were you a small boy in Germany when
yes,
this
I
happened?
Was. Yes, I was.
Interesting.
And it was really a complete, I don't know, people were extremely shocked back then that that would happen. Because you also mentioned, you know, the Olympics in 36. And I don't think that the Olympics in 72 were something about getting Germany back on track with the civilized world, so to say. I think that had happened actually before. It was something more of giving Germany these Olympics and 2 years later, the World Soccer Championship, which went smooth. More or less to say that, yes, the Germans are back on track already. They are very efficient. You can give them this kind of mega event, and they will organize it well. Mm-hmm. So it was more of a, well, here we have that almost like a result of having been good.
Martin, thank you. We're going to take a short break. We're talking about the movie, One Day in September, about the Munich Olympics of 1972. This is The Connection from WBUR Boston. Funding for The Connection comes from the listeners of WBUR Boston, where The Connection is produced, and from the Allaire Corporation, empowering people with innovative internet technology and offering dynamic career opportunities at allaire.com. From Boston University, this is WBUR, Boston's NPR news station. In the second hour of The Connection at 11...
...the village, and is observing this with the naked eye. Peter?
Jim, I am almost directly over the Israeli building. It will be a famous number before long. It's building 31. It's on Connolly Strasse. It does appear to be confirmed, though anything confirmed today is difficult, that these guerrillas are from one of the very extreme left-wing groups, a group called Black September. Continuous delegations go forward, people here waiting, but unquestionably the mood becoming more tense.
That was ABC Television's live coverage of the terror at the Munich Olympics in 1972. I must say, looking back, it was television journalism to be proud of it, to tip your hat to Peter Jennings and Jim McKay. How good Jim McKay was at everything, and probably still is. We're talking about the movie One Day in September, a 28-year hindsight on the Olympics of Terror, with the movie director Arthur Cohn.
Movie producer.
Producer, I beg your pardon, and the director Kevin MacDonald, who won the Oscar in the documentary category last spring. Congratulations, by the way, on the Oscar, but I also wanted to say this is a movie that unsettles an awful lot of people in Israel, in Europe, among the Palestinians too, I suspect, and I think it's going to churn up a lot of American reaction. Distill the criticism, Kevin MacDonald, if you will, and respond to it.
Sorry, I didn't catch the end of that.
Well, I simply wanted you to respond to the criticism. There's a lot of it, and it's all provocative and interesting, and I think it's just going to be the beginning when it hits an American audience.
It has been a very provocative film, very controversial film. What I suppose to me has been the good side of that is that the controversy has been on all sides, that we have had a largely positive response everywhere, but a minority negative response in every territory, as it were. Also, some of the Palestinians, some Israelis, and some Germans have responded badly to the film, which I suppose leads me to suspect that, you know, we must have got something about right in the balance.
Something right or everything wrong, one or the other.
But on the other hand, as I said, a lot of people have liked this movie. I think, you know, it's hard to quantify these things, but obviously the audiences that I have seen it with and the Academy Award
committees, etc., have liked the film. So it's not as though it's a very sizable minority even who dislikes.
The Israeli objection, as I gather it, it ranges from your use of just horrible pictures of dead bodies, and bloody dormitory rooms, that kind of thing, and also there's some suspicion that you sympathize too much or you show too much of the Palestinian terrorist. Do you want to respond?
Well, I mean, I think what you've got to remember with these, with a story like this, is that any story connected to the Middle East, but certainly one that involves that stirs up so many strong emotions. And also includes the whole history of Israel and Germany of the last 50 years, which is a whole other set of complications. Of course, is that there are great emotions at work here, and you're never going to please everybody. I don't think it would be possible to please everybody. I think if we did, we'd be making a most bland and uninteresting film, which we wouldn't be talking about now.
Well, on the other side, I'd like
there
you to
have
just
been sorry. There have been. In Israel, so some people on the right wing who have disapproved of the fact that we've shown the surviving terrorist Jamal in a relatively sympathetic light, and that even that we've let him talk at all, because some people believe that you shouldn't allow a terrorist or an ex-terrorist the oxygen of publicity, as Margaret Thatcher once called it. With regards to the photographs that we've used, yes, there was some objection to some of the photographs that we used, which we got from the police in Munich, which are the photographs of the aftermath of the killings, really, at the airport. We were told about these by the spokeswoman for the families, for the widows of the athletes who died, and encouraged to use them because they want this story to make a big impact. It hasn't made the impact that they feel it should have done, and we agreed with that. I agree with that very strongly. I think you can only really show people what happened there, the real brutality of it, the true horror of it, if you actually confront people with those images. I mean, part of what is so strange about this in the public perception, the story, is everybody knows a little bit about it, but everybody's only seen those few little images, the few tantalizing images of heads over balconies, of heads at windows, you know, a few very, very grainy shots of people with guns.
Yeah, could I just say that on the other side is precisely the problem, the objection of the Palestinian critic Edward Said, who gave you a strong blast in the British press, saying that this movie really just underlines the very narrowness, the harshness, the oversimplicity of the equation of Palestinian and terrorist.
Well, except of course that, well, I mean, I could spend a long time going into discussing with you Edward Said's article, which was a particularly intemperate piece of journalism. Well, to call it journalism, I think, would be to use the term wrongly. But
it was criticism, and it was very strong.
It was very strong. I think preposterously strong, considering the response that we had. Equally badly in some Israeli quarters from right-wing people in Israel.
Well, that doesn't answer everything.
In Germany. What made Mr. Said's article, you know, for me, as somebody who really admired him previously and who admired his work previously, what made me very disappointed was how inaccurate it was and how full of innuendo it was. To give you one example only, he states boldly that we did not get any help from any Palestinian researchers. There's not a single Palestinian name in the credits. Well, there are three researchers credited. One of them is called Khalil Abed Rabo, an extremely Palestinian name, and he's actually identified as Palestinian researcher. So if someone of Mr. Said's standing can't even read the credits on your film, one has to wonder about how seriously to take the rest of his criticisms.
That was not the core of his criticism, to be fair, Kevin McDonald, but go ahead. Arthur Cohen.
I believe the problem with the article of Professor Said is that he didn't understand the purpose of the film. Kevin MacDonald went out of his way to show an accurate and authentic picture of what really happened in Munich, and we call the Munich One Day in September. The film is about one day in September, and it is absolutely not about 50 years of rivalry between Israel and the Palestinians. At the same time, in regard to the Israeli complaints. I was in Israel last Monday where there was a gala premiere in Jerusalem, and the reaction was extremely positive. The complaint about the Jamal coming off too believable, oddly enough, comes from the same family members who complained about the photos. And Kevin and I met with them repeatedly in Israel, and we told them it makes no sense that on the one hand you say the terrorist is too believable and should have been cut down in size, and on the other hand you want to forbid us to use photos which do show the terror he committed. So the two things together do not go together in my personal view and in Kevin's view, and we tried to convince them that this is so.
But in terms of, Kevin, let me put this to you. In the human story of Jamal Al-Ghashi, might you have interviewed his relatives in the same fashion that you interviewed the widow of the Israeli fencing coach, for example?
Well, yeah,
learn
I mean,
his story, his
this
past.
Is an interesting, yeah, it's an interesting question. I mean, obviously, the reason one interviews the widow of... what we tried to do, I should explain, first of all, is we tried to tell two stories in parallel through the film, the story of one of the Israeli athletes and the one Palestinian, and to constantly flick between the two of them through the film. That's the kind of basic structure of the story. Now, obviously, we have the Palestinian. He is alive. He can talk for himself. But we don't have the Israeli athlete. We have his widow, who talks on his behalf, essentially. Therefore, it didn't feel appropriate to put in Jamal's family. On the other hand, I did actually try very hard to get Jamal's family to appear on camera. And this is, again, some of the naivety, I think, of Mr. Saeed's article, that it's not easy to get someone like this to appear on camera. It's very, very hard to get them to get their family to appear, which is very much what I wanted to do. It would have made a very different film, I think, if we had had his family, but I would have been very, very happy to go down that different direction. Similarly, the reason that Jamal appears in shadow, which again I think Mr. Saeed criticizes as reinforcing the sense of the sinister terrorist. Well, it's not my desire that he appears in shadow. I would very, very much like it if he didn't. That's the desire of the subject, of Jamal. So you have
to one can see you're stuck there. I mean, that's a hard spot to be in. If you had been able to shoot him, you know, with studio lighting.
I would very much like to, and in fact, originally he agreed to that and to be shot like everybody else. I mean, the aim of the way that I shot everybody in the film was to give everybody a similar footing in the film. Nobody is shot in a way that everyone's shot in a very sort of abstract, very, very similar sort of way, with no particular identifying backgrounds and that kind of thing. So I want people to concentrate on each person as an individual. Now, Jamal is obviously shot differently from that, but that's because it's outside of my power to shoot him in the way that I would like to have shot him. Now, anybody who is discussing the film needs to bear that in mind, and I think that that's where Mr. Saeed, I think, showed his naivety about the filmmaking process.
Kevin McDonald, stand by for callers, please. And Arthur Cohen, we're talking about One Day in September, the Oscar-winning movie about the Munich Olympics of 1972. Sarah is on the line.
Hi.
Hello,
thank
Sarah.
You for having me on your show, to allow me to speak. I have not read really article by Professor Saeed, but I also add my voice to, I don't know, whatever, you know, what he said. But I think the problem with this film, or this kind of film, is just making, you know, in vacuum. I don't know if they are talking about what happened that these people really reacted this way. And I'm surprised that one of your guests, he said he's surprised that even up to this day, the person who was involved did not apologize and still say, you know, I'm not, you know, ashamed of whatever I did. The problem is that we are not really, they are not going to tell us what happened, that these people reacted this way. This is a state of war. It was a war that these people were forced at gunpoint to get out of their land. And if Mr. Lyon or the other guest, you would do exactly the same thing. But the problem is because they have so much power, they give this film an Oscar, and it's very interesting that this film is talked about at this time that there is pressure on Palestinians still do more compromise. That's very interesting to me.
Well, I would like to, that's a very interesting point. I'd like to say that obviously the timing of this film is completely coincidental. We started making it, I think, almost 4 years ago, and it was off and on and off and on, and finally finished about a year ago. So it is complete coincidence of that on that level. With regards, I mean, if it ties in with anything, I think it ties in probably with the Olympic Games. I think if there was any commercial reasoning behind the release of the film, it's now, obviously, because of the Olympic Games. With regards to your point about putting this in context, well, this is a very, very difficult point. We had an hour and a half film here, and we wanted to tell the story of what that one day, primarily wanted to tell a story and to reveal what really happened on that day. Now, therefore, there's only so much background information one can put in, and I very consciously wanted to put in just the minimum necessary, what would actually be necessary for people to understand what was going on.
Fair enough. Let's move. 1-800-423-TALK is the phone. Cynthia is on the line.
Hi.
Hello, Cynthia.
Hi. I don't want to take away from the horror of the Olympics, but it was about the very same time that I was also a victim of Black September. And so it's very hard for me to think of it as an isolated event. I was on a plane going from Rome to Tel Aviv, and there was a bomb on it that went off that was supposedly well reported to have been placed there by Black September. Long story.
The bomb went off and you're still here?
Yes.
How so?
Oh, well...
Your parachute?
No, three reasons that we were given over time. One, that it was a time bomb, not an altimeter bomb, and the plane was leaving an hour late, so we were not near the altimeter altitude we needed to be for it to explode and implode. Two, because at the time, El Al was the only airline that had an armor-surrounded baggage compartment. Hmm. And three, because the pilot was an Israeli war hero who knew how to land a plane in just about any circumstance.
Where do we go from there, Cindy? I mean, the question about this movie is how that imagery, how those memories, how that casting, self-casting, one has to say, of the Palestinian characters has shaped our world and our minds. How is it? I mean, you are blessed to recover. You're blessed to be here at all. How has it affected you?
Well, for about 5 years, it didn't affect me too much, but for the last 15 years or so, I have not been able to get on a plane. And if I do, it's only with the assistance of a half a dozen Valiums. And it's when you have children and you want to take them traveling, or you're by yourself and you want to travel and you've loved traveling all your life, it obviously takes away a good part of your life. So it's not really an isolated event of one day in September. It's other events, and I know because no one died on our plane miraculously, that it wasn't going to get the attention that this and other horrible events have. But it's not just an isolated event, and it affects a lot of people's lives, and it affects innocent people's lives who are not wearing army uniforms and who are not in the line of battle.
Cynthia, thank you. Nice to have you still on the planet. 1-800-423-8255 makes the one day in September connection. Stacy is on the line.
Hi. I think my comment sort of follows pretty well because I want to share an experience I had. I am originally from Atlanta, and so I was present at the Atlanta Olympic Games in 1996. And there was a ceremony at the Atlanta Jewish Federation dedicating a memorial to the Munich 11. And this happened, I think, the day after the bomb went off in Atlanta Centennial Village. And at that ceremony, I had the opportunity to talk with some of the Israeli athletes who were in Atlanta, and I asked them how they felt about the bomb going off and whether it surprised them, and none of them were shocked. They were all they expected this. This is still a part of their lives every day. It didn't shock them that a bomb would go off, it didn't shock them that it would happen at the Olympics. This is still so much a part of their memory.
Stacey, thank you. Kevin McDonald, I'd like to go sort of back to the beginning. There was there were all manner of miscalculations here and unintended consequences. But sorting through it, what was the net imprint, do you think, of this event on our times, almost 30 years ago, and yet it's like yesterday?
Well, I think that for I wasn't old enough to have recalled this personally myself. I'm 32 years old. I was 4 years old when it happened. I knew probably as much as most people of my generation know about it, which is that some Israeli athletes died, that it was in Munich, that there were Palestinians responsible. But I knew no more than that. And I think that what has surprised me is that although for all the generations this is a key event, I think, in the second half of the 20th century in terms of people, the shock and the impact that it's made, and I think it really is on a par with the death of JFK for many people, people still didn't really know what had happened. And there had been, I think, a conscious and an unconscious desire to cover this up, in Germany in particular, as to really what had happened, the details of the story. And when I was starting to research it, I was astonished by how confused, how contradictory the reports about what had happened were. And I was astonished by how people didn't want to talk about it still. For instance, Hans-Dietrich Genscher, who was the interior minister of Germany at the time, later went on to be, I think, the longest-serving foreign minister anywhere in the world. He had never, ever given an interview to the press about what had happened that day, even though he was there, he was the key negotiator during most of the day for the German government. He had never spoken to the press about this. Well, you know, that would never happen, I don't think, in America. I don't suppose it would happen in Britain, where I'm from.
I wonder, there are so many possibilities about the way your kids and the next generation, the viewer generation, is going to remember this after seeing your movie. There's one telltale little moment, though, in which the mayor of the Olympic Village says, you know, in other circumstances, I could have liked that man, Issa, that he was negotiating with. He didn't say we could have done business.
But I think he says we could have been friends, I think. I think it's his words.
What did that mean? What did that tell you?
I think it's a fascinating comment. I think it's one of those comments which is the reason why documentaries are worth doing, why it's better to make a documentary sometimes than it is to write a book. Obviously, you can put far more detail into a book. You can put all the background that one of your previous callers was wanting into a book that you can't put into a film. But there are certain things that documentary film can do, and one of them is to give you these little insights into people's characters. And that moment there, this man says, you know, he's negotiating with these terrorists. They've already killed two people. They're going to go on to kill another nine people. And yet he can say, I actually liked this man. I could have been friends with him. Now, obviously, you can look at that. Some audience will look at that and say, that's terribly callous. How can he say that? Other people will look at that and say, well, yes, because this man was a human being, and he was probably a human being with this man, Issa, the terrorist I'm talking about, was a human being. He was probably, in some ways, an attractive and interesting person. I think it rounds out the whole issue. Those kind of little moments are the things that really round out the story.
Arthur Cohen, what do you expect the viewer generation?
Sorry, I'm afraid I'm going to have to go now.
Kevin, with our thanks enormously for the movie, and thank you for joining us on The Connection. Arthur Cohen, what do you expect for the rising generation that doesn't remember the event, that'll learn about it in this movie? What do you expect them to remember?
Well, it is the first time that there is a movie which has been researched for nearly 3 years and which shows in an authentic manner what happened in Munich, given all protagonists, the Palestinian, the Israeli, the German, and others, the chance to voice whatever their attitude was in order to allow us to get a clear imprint of what happened. I have shown the film a week ago in Lausanne, Switzerland, to the now president of the Olympic movement, Mr. Samrach, who flew in for the occasion from Spain. And he was extremely impressed by the film because he felt that the film is part of Olympic history. We did not want to show more than one day in September. It was not our aim, and it was our insistence to show an authentic view of what happened that day in September.
It's an incredibly gripping movie, and it's been an interesting hour talking with you about it. Thank you, Arthur Cohn and Kevin MacDonald. Their Academy Award-winning documentary is called One Day in September. It'll be broadcast on HBO next Monday, September 11th at 8 o'clock. You can also keep talking about it on our website at theconnectiononeword.org. I'm Christopher Lydon. This is The Connection from WBUR Boston. Funding for The Connection comes from the listeners of WBUR Boston, where The Connection is produced, and from the Allaire Corporation.
This is WBUR. We're funded by you, our listeners, and by Fornova, building innovative B2B solutions that enable e-commerce for buyers and sellers of any size. Now hiring talented software engineering professionals on the web at Fornova.com. And by Brookline Booksmith, sponsoring Armistead Mofin, author of Tales of the City, October 4th.